Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Gallup, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. And talking about eminently qualified, you exaggerate in my case, but we certainly do in yours. So thank you very much for getting us on the show one more time and help us set this up. And with us tonight, of course, are Mike Sorrento and Lucy Spears doing deep research for us tonight. And I think you'll find this show interesting if you ever listen to it and stay for the whole show. Tonight we're going to be talking about, is it Jesse James? Is it Jesse James? I think it's Jesse James. Wouldn't that be interesting? Jesse James and the younger Gent brothers and their robbery of First National Bank of Northern Minnesota, Northfield, Minnesota, excuse me. I think you'll find this very interesting. The guy that wrote the book, his book is entitled, catchy little title, it's called Shot All to Hell, Jesse James, the Northfield Raid and the Wild West's Greatest Escape. And his previous book, Mark Lee Gardner's book, is author of To Hell on a Fast Horse, The Untold Story of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. So very interesting, and I think you'll enjoy this extremely well historical researcher talk about these particular cases. And I love this cowboy stuff. Anyway, anybody watch the Country Music Association Awards last night? I thought it was a real hoot. Where they very early in the show they opened up with who was it? It was Brad Paisley and I think Carrie Underwood singing Obamacare in the Morning. They were, like everyone else, are poking fun at the Obamacare web project and people's inability to sign up. I think they have some people signed up now, but, you know, I don't know if it's as complicated as people are making it. But anyway, let's don't talk about that. But welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Got to remember, you can get a show. I was talking to a fine gentleman today about this. How long would it take me to get a show? Can I get a show? Yeah, I told him, you can get a show. And I think it's about 3 or 4 minutes. You are signed up, and you're ready to go. You could broadcast now or any time later that you want to. I haven't looked at the details lately, but if you're broadcasting on prime time, like 7 to 10, it might cost you a little bit per month. That's what I pay. But if it's outside of those hours, it doesn't cost you one penny, and you can broadcast worldwide. So that's something. Thinking of Johnny Cash, we had a tractor trailer overturned not too far from our home broadcasting center here and blocked the road. But, you know, I don't have much trouble with truckers anymore like they used to. Can you remember what they used to do? I got to check that record. I'd like to see if anybody's written anything about that in detail. But it seems like they're more polite now. They don't ride on your tail anymore and that type of thing. And I haven't seen a truck accident in a long time. I did have one squirt some ice on me as I went by because of the tires threw up some ice and put a little dent in the side of my car. But aside from that, I think these guys have a rough job. Can you imagine doing that? Boy, time is money. And if you want to read about stuff like that, then read Stud Turkle's book about working. And he's got a chapter in there on truck drivers, and time is money. Some of you truck drivers are probably listening. You know more about that than I did. But anyway, the show, we want to talk about news issues and events, even if they're historical, about crime and justice, and sometimes the humorous practice of criminal justice. There's some of that around also. Dedicate this show to these energetic and tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who aren't perfect. Some are. Some aren't. Some make a mess up and they get re-educated and they're back on the job and they're doing well. But it's tough. Think of the silly stuff that you get calls on. I mean, if you were ever a cop and working a cruiser, and I did that for 5 years, I mean, some of the stuff that people call you about, you wouldn't believe. Really? Why did you call me for that? But no, you can't even do that. You have to be polite, that type of thing. And I hope police officers today do that, just like I did back in the Ice Age. So anyway, remember, if you want to get a show, you can get one of your own. And I've already told you what's on the show tonight. I'm trying to hurry because this is an interesting show, and I want you to hear as much of it as possible. Then you can go to booktv.org and hear the rest of it. It's about an hour and maybe 40 minutes, I think, something like that, they'll say when they get started here tonight. But I think you'll really enjoy this this particular thing. Remember what Book TV is for primarily. It's for academics and university faculty who don't read books, but that now they can act like they read books because they can go in there and see new books every week and thousands of them marked. I'm kidding a little bit, but there are some that I run into that have never heard of BookTV.org. I mean, I've been watching Book TV on television, C-SPAN channels, for a long time, and you stay right up to date on certain things. And then, you know, if you like the book, then you go buy it when you hear it talked about on Book TV. All right, let's get rolling here. Audrey, I'm going to go ahead and do your blind joke for you here tonight, okay? Is that okay? Yeah. You're busy doing something anyway, so I'll do it. All right, here's a good blonde joke. Two blondes are sitting at Starbucks one day when a truckload of sod rolls by. The one blonde told the other one day when I get rich, I want to do that. The other blonde says, do what? The other one asks. Have my yard sent out to be mowed. She thought that the truckload of sod was somebody's grass that she sent out to be mowed. Very good. I like that one. Do you like that one, Mike? I think that's a hoot. My gosh. Okay. Yeah, that's a cool one. Had my sod sent out to be mowed, or my yard sent out to be mowed. That'd be an interesting idea. Probably. I was reading today or yesterday about this company called Peapod. Have you ever heard of them? I think they're out of business now, but they didn't have to be. They sold it to somebody else. These are the guys that started back in the 1980s. And what they did is, or the guy, what he did was deliver groceries to home. He linked up a whole bunch of groceries for Kroger's in Cincinnati and a bunch of the national chains and in a bunch of cities around the United States. And I think he made money from what I've heard. It worked out, you know, okay. But anyway, it's interesting to hear what people do to make money. I don't know how to do that. But anyway, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we do want to play a public service announcement about the Ohio Gun Coalition. And let's go ahead and hear their public service announcement. And what they want to do is have all the criminals turn in their firearms. So here's one by the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It is. It's a deadly idea. And please, criminals on the street, as you listen to this, go ahead and turn in your firearms. We've been playing this announcement for a long time. The green tip, I'm going to do it tonight because I thought of one based on what I heard today on the Fox News channel, that Twitter went public today on the stock market, I guess, on the exchange, and I don't know much about, you know, stock markets and all that stuff. In fact, all the abbreviations confuse me. I should study up on that sometime. I believe in hillbilly economics. That's all I know is, you know, you stuff your wallet full of money. When it's empty, you can't spend anymore. You got to go make some. But that's something that people make a lot of money. But anyway, the green tip is on the social media, I can't believe we're going crazy. There's even a radio show on Blog Talk Network on how the social media stuff is used in sports and on and on and on. And we've talked about it a long time before a lot of people did. Sherry Turkle's book, Alone Together, these people are going crazy, even more so now with Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I mean, they are spending their life online. And that's something, you know, we have, you know, people are being bullied through Twitter accounts and Instagram and all Facebook and that kind of junk. They're being bullied. And, you know, one answer to that, turn it all off. If you, you know, turn it off and live. I think I'm going to get a bumper sticker that says that, turn your phone off and live. One of my colleague friends at the university had one on the back of his van that said, turn it off and drive, hang up your phone and drive. That's what it was. Yeah, that's a good one. And I've seen enough people almost run into me, and you have too, who are talking on their cell phone. Some people are really addicted to that idea. But if you turn it all off, think of the energy we'd be saving, that type of thing. Oh, my gosh. Okay, what we're going to do now is take a look at some news. There's certainly a lot of stuff going on in the world, and we can't cover it all, but I picked these out as news stories that I think you might be interested in also. Our friend Google is testing a new program that tracks you everywhere you go. No, they must be kidding me. Google is beta testing a program that tracks users' purchasing habits by registering brick-and-mortar store visits via their smartphones. I didn't know you had to turn that junk off on Google. I didn't know that Google could trace you anyway, even if you said you don't want to be traced, you got to do more. But Google can access user data via Android apps or their Apple iOS apps. Boy, Apple's getting a lot of hits on their new upgrade. I know I have an Apple iPhone, and it had some kinks in it this time, but and normally it doesn't. Like Google Search, Gmail, Chrome, or Google Maps, they're doing that. I wish Google would pay for my purchases in the store. That'd be okay. But if a customer is using these apps while they shop or has them still running in the background, Google's new program pinpoints the origin of his user data. Can you believe that? And then it determines if the customer is in a place of business. Then Google gets permission to do this kind of tracking when Android users opt in to the location services on their smartphones. So the program is, you know, the idea is when advertisers love to know as much as possible about purchasers' habits, they can target their ads more efficiently and reap the benefits. In other words, it's all for your benefit too, folks. So don't worry about Google. They wouldn't be snooping on us, would they, and turning data over to the federal government? No, they couldn't do anything like that. Okay. I love this one, Jersey City, New Jersey. The law enforcement people there, they're going to launch a safe surrender initiative. That's kind of like turning in your firearms if you're a criminal, that allows nonviolent offenders with arrest warrants out for them. They can have their cases resolved quickly, often without jail time. So it's a four-day program, and I guess it starts Wednesday and runs through Saturday, what would have started yesterday. And it's at Evangelismo's Greek Orthodox Church in Jersey City. It's open to U.S. citizens and legal residents wanted for nonviolent crimes or disorderly person offenses, including family matters, so it would be family disturbance cases too, and child support. It's not an amnesty program, but it does offer, they say, favorable consideration from the court. So you get reduced fines and probation instead of jail time. I'm going to follow up on that and see how well that works out. Just come in and turn yourself in, and we'll take care of you. Well, they will feed you if they lock you up, but maybe not the best for doing that. Have you read the story that everybody's commented about in Deming, New Mexico, or you've heard about it on television? This is a New Mexico man that claims he was anally probed several times by police and medical officials following a traffic stop. Now, we need more details in this case because we can't tell exactly what's going on. But this guy fails to make a complete stop at a stop sign outside of a Walmart. He gets out of his car. Officers indicated that he believes he was in possession of drugs in his anal cavity. They say that when he stepped out of his car, he was standing in a manner that looked as if he was clenching his buttocks. I'm not exactly how you detect that with a lot of surety, but he was allegedly standing in a manner that claimed that he was clenching his buttocks. They say he was clenching his buttocks. A judge granted a search warrant to perform an anal cavity search on Mr. Eckert shortly after he was taken into custody. And then they report that a doctor refused to perform the anal cavity search at an emergency room, saying it was unethical. Eckert was then transferred, that doctor I like, Eckert was then transported to Gila Regional Medical Center, where his alleged trauma began. According to the lawsuit, Eckert's abdominal area was x-rayed twice. Doctors stuck fingers in his anus twice. He had three enemas inserted anally and had a colonoscopy performed. No drugs were found during the search. As you can imagine, the guy's searching. Now, the police chief of Deming, he says that his department always follows the law. So it's going to be interesting to see how that church, that case turns out. That might be one of them calls, if you're a cop, that I wish I was on another call. having been a cop, I've never done that type of search, and we'll see what happens with that type of thing. Takes a lot of time to talk about this, but Supreme Court's going to look at another case about prayer in public meetings, where they're starting out public meetings. They've endorsed this several times in the past. President Obama endorses, as a matter of fact. He said this is a historical part of the United States. You know, we've been doing this since the beginning of time. And, you know, if you don't want to hear it, well, Obama didn't say that, but, you know, don't listen to it. Neither federal courts nor legislative bodies are well suited to police the content of prayers. Anyway, the Congress does the same thing when a chaplain is a Christian chaplain. So we'll see how that one turns out, but I hope we're not going to turn something like that that around. How about this? The New York City cops, they handcuff a man and two of his friends who are not guilty of any crime and then force one of them to perform a rap song to get his freedom. He was staying in a friend's apartment, and they asked to enter the apartment, but later left when the friend demanded to see a warrant. Later that day, plainclothes officers convinced a building supervisor to let them into the apartment. I'm not sure that's legal either, at which point the alleged abuse took place. Mr. Shingles and two others were handcuffed while officers searched the premises, the suit says. They didn't find anything illegal. The officers told Mr. Shingles, who was an aspiring musician, that if his rhymes were hot, if they were hot, they would let him go. He did as he was told, and the handcuffs were removed. I guess he's a pretty good entertainer. You know, I've never heard of an axe-throwing woman, but there's competition where you can actually throw an axe. And she used an axe. Where did this take place? Southern California somewhere. She actually used an axe to chase a burglar from her house. I guess the only thing better than that, I guess, would be a gun. But she's a tomahawk-throwing champion, and she quickly grabbed a throwing axe and chased the man out of the apartment. I'm going to look that up on YouTube. I've never seen an axe throwing competition. I think I've seen people do it, but I didn't know it was an actual contest. Speaking of that, how many of you folks are in favor of child cage fighting? Have you heard people talking about this on television or this kind of thing? Look on YouTube. Put in child cage fighting. They have these kids doing this full combat whatever stuff without helmets or not. They're wearing gloves and that kind of, they're punching each other and throwing them down on the ground, beating them in the face. I think one of them, if you're up to like 10 or something like that, you can't do that. But I got a video linked of two girls, 12 or 13, throwing one down on the deck, choking her, and then punching her in the face continuously. How in the world can that be legal? We don't even let football players play without a helmet. But who in the world I know it's competition, but who would go see that? What parent would allow their kid to be punched continuously in the face, bloody nose, and that kind of stuff? Ah, that is weird. I can't believe it. This is a sad story, and then we'll get to our feature event of the evening. We had a case here in Washington County Sheriff's Office where a baby girl died Sunday morning after her intoxicated mother passed out while breastfeeding the child. This is Hagerstown, Maryland. Yadina Morales, 22, woke up at 7 a.m. to find her two-month-old daughter underneath her and unresponsive in the home. The mother was highly intoxicated. She'd actually been breastfeeding the child. She passed out and ultimately smothered the child, the sheriff says. Can you believe that? I mean, anyway, they're charging her with manslaughter, second-degree child abuse, reckless endangerment, and other charges, and she's out on bond. But isn't that incredible to have a child and breastfeed your child while you're stone drunk? I mean, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. One last story. I like this one. The cops are now starting to crack down on cell phone use in cars. This is in Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland. It's about time, isn't it? I mean, some people can't even drive without putting a cell phone up. And the record, I've already seen it once, but I saw it in my little town here where I live. A woman turning into McDonald's, talking on two cell phones at the same time. That's hard to do. She had the right ear was covered to her shoulder and the wheel. She had her head way down on the shoulder, and she had a cell phone in her left hand and actually making a left turn into McDonald's restaurant. I mean, that's tricky to be able to do that, but also very dangerous. I wonder what she'd do if one of the phones slipped and fell out, the one from her shoulder. Who knows? That's the news for tonight. Let's go ahead and hear about this character called whom? Jesse James. Give me time to set this up, but this is called Shot to Hell, Jesse James, the Northfield Raid, and the Wild West's Greatest Escape. This is by the scholar Mark Lee Gardner, and he's also author of the book To Hell on a Fast Horse, The Untold Story of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. I think you'll enjoy this. Here we go.
Recalls the life of outlaw Jesse James, next on Book TV. Mr. Gardner recounts the infamous James Younger Gaines robbery of the First National Bank of Northfield, Minnesota on September 7th.
Book TV's thinking about it. Hold on a second.
Mark Lee Gardner recalls the life of outlaw Jesse James, next on Book TV. Mr. Gardner recounts the infamous James Younger Gaines robbery of the First National Bank of Northfield, Minnesota on September 7, 1876, and the two-week manhunt that followed. This is an hour and 10 minutes.
You all didn't know you were going to get a show tonight. But it is Friday night, so I'm going to have some kind of a show. I found that the best time machine is music. Books are a close second, and I really try to transport the reader back in time with that books. But music gets you there instantly. You know, you hear a Bob Dylan song, you're back in the 60s. You hear a Stephen Foster song, you're back in the 19th century. So let's go back in time to 19th century Missouri, when even during the worst of times and the Civil War and then later the depredations of the notorious James Younger Gang, people had great songs and great music that they sang.
Thank you.
go get a jump. Throw those Anna's family stuff. Get out the way. Get out the way. Get out the way, old man Tucker. He's too late. Get his stuff. Get out the way. Get out the way. Get out the way, old man Tucker. He's too late. Get his stuff. Take a walk, just a little walk. Her feet covered up the whole sidewalk. But she was fair to view. Buffalo gal, come out tonight. Come out tonight. Come out tonight. Buffalo gal, come out tonight. Southern dear, your punt from all you up with worse than just to call you. Two arms. The walls making fires are lighted a little hard. Now united, two arms. And then the flag of Dixie, hurrah. And Dixie's land will take our stand and live or die. Two arms. And conquer peace for Dixie. Two arms. And conquer peace for Dixie. Yes, we'll rally around the flag, boys, we'll rally once again. Shouting the battle cry of freedom, we will rally around the hillside, we'll gather from the plain. Shouting the battle cry of freedom, the Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally around the flag, boys, rally once again. Shouting the battle cry of freedom. I'm Captain Hanks of the Horse Marines. I feed my horse on corn and beans, escort young ladies in their teens. Though a captain in the army, I teach young ladies how to dance, how to dance, how to dance. I teach young ladies how to dance, for I'm the pet of the army. If Jesse was your friend, on him you couldn't depend. If it be true, I'm sure. He always wore the belt that would equalize the wealth. He would rob the rich for the poor. It was with his brother Frank. He robbed his galloping bank and carried the money from the town. It was at that very place they had a little shake before they shot Captain Sheen to the ground. Jesse had a wife, the pride of his life. His children, they were brave. But the dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard has laid Jesse James in his grave. I went down to the depot not very long ago, the agent for the sea. He fell upon his knees and delivered up the key to the outlaws, Frank and Jesse James. It was on Wednesday night, the moon was shining bright. They robbed the Glendale train. The people, they'd stay for many miles away. It was robbed by Frank and Jesse James. Jesse had a wife, the pride of his life. His children, they were brave. But the dirty little coward had shot Mr. Howard, has laid Jesse James in his grave. You know, that summer, June 25th, on the banks of the Little Bighorn River, Montana Territory. George Armstrong Custer and more than 200 men under his immediate command are massacred or wiped out by Lakota and Cheyenne warriors. That same summer, a former lawman with long flowing locks was shot in the back of the head in Deadwood, South Dakota. His name was Wild Bill Hickok. There were swarms and swarms of locusts that covered the skies of the Midwest, thousands and thousands, and they devoured the barley, oats, and wheat of Minnesota and Iowa and Missouri. The damage was so extensive for the last several years, it amounted to over $8 million by 1876, and that's 1876 dollars. The panic of 1873 was still being felt in 1876. It cost all kinds of jobs. It dropped the prices of crops. Many businesses failed. And the Grant administration was racked with scandal, so they weren't of much help either. Many, many corrupt officials were part of that administration. There were all kinds of congressional hearings going after various parties. But there was one thing that was very, very exciting in the summer of 1876, and it was occurring in Philadelphia, the famed Centennial Exposition. Tens of thousands of people visited the exposition every day, and they saw all kinds of marvels and wonders, all types of inventions, sewing machines, typewriters, the telephone, gleaming brass telescopes, a rapid-fire weapon called the Gatling gun, a foot pedal drill for dentists, the newest life-saving devices for sailors, all kinds of wonders there going on. There were so many people that were going to this exposition that there were special trains that left from all points, from the West, the Midwest, and you could get a ticket, a special ticket to take you to Philadelphia. Tens of thousands of people each day went through those gates, and thousands of people rode the railroads going eastward to visit that amazing thing. In Northfield, Minnesota, the bank's cashier had gone with his family to Philadelphia to see the fair, and the other employees had to fill in while he was gone for a couple of weeks there in September. But while all these people were going east to the fair, in Missouri, there were eight men that boarded a train about St. Joseph, Missouri, and they were going north. And they weren't going to any fair. They were going to have a little fun in a place of Minnesota to spend a couple of weeks up there. There was a notorious James Younger gang, Frank and Jesse James, Cole Younger, Bob Younger, Jim Younger, Clell Miller, Bill Chadwell, and Charlie Pitts. They had about their persons three to four revolvers each. They were loaded down with ammunition in their ammunition belts, and they rode with dusters on over their clothing. Now, historically, a duster is meant to protect your nice clothes from the dirt of the road. You know, there's not really any paved roads in 1876. If you ride a buggy or a saddle horse, you can get pretty dusty. So these dusters were meant to protect your clothing, but they also concealed weapons very handily. Now, why Minnesota? Why would the James Younger gang, again, the quintessential horseback outlaws, the most successful outlaw band in American history, why would they go north? Well, in July of 1876, they had had a very successful haul at Rocky Cut, Missouri. It's right near Otterville, the town of Otterville today, the small town of Otterville on the banks of the Lamine River. They had gotten $15,000, but their first big mistake came out of that robbery, and that was a new recruit. They recruited someone who wasn't really quite as trustworthy and wasn't quite as loyal and seasoned as the rest of the gang. His name was Hobbs Carey. Now, Hobbs Carey, his share of the loot was about $1,200 out of this $15,000 haul. But he was pretty obvious about spending his money. And after a very short time, he was out of it all but about $20. He lost it in the gambling halls in Joplin and elsewhere. And the St. Louis police were on to him. And they captured him and interrogated him. And Hobbs Carey confessed everything. Not only did he confess his role in the robbery, but he named all the other gang members that were part of the gang. He also told about where they liked to hide out. He learned quite a bit in his short time with the gang. So it made it fairly hot in Missouri for the Jameses and the Youngers and the others because the detectives were on their trail. And when it was hot for them, they went someplace where they were least expected. Minnesota was that kind of place. No one in Minnesota would have ever expected the James Younger gang to go there, and they were not being hunted there. But there was also another reason to go to Minnesota, and that was revenge. Jesse James, if anything, was all about revenge, and it started with the Civil War and the Bushwhackers, and it was always retaliation, getting back the Federals for what they had done or what was perceived they were done. And then later, as an outlaw, someone had attempted to harm Jesse or harmed his family, he was out to get him, and this was well known. And there was a man from Liberty, Missouri, an attorney named Samuel Hardwick. And Samuel Hardwick had made the mistake of assisting Alan Pinkerton and Alan Pinkerton's efforts to capture the James brothers. And Samuel Hardwick had worked with Pinkerton to set up a midnight raid on the James farm near Kearney, Missouri, in January of 1875. In that raid, the Pinkertons surrounded the house. They threw through one of the windows. They broke a window and tossed in what was known or is known now as an incendiary device. The idea supposedly was to start a fire of some kind to illuminate the interior and also to set the house on fire. So what this incendiary device did was explode. It didn't just set a fire. The James family would always call it a grenade. They thought the intent was to blow up the house from the very beginning. Well, Jesse and Frank were not in the house, as Samuel Hardwick believed, but the family was there, and Jesse's mother was maimed for life. They had to amputate her arm right near the elbow. And even worse, Jesse's half-brother, Archie Samuel, a young boy, was killed, fatally wounded by this exploding device. Once Jesse learned that Samuel Hardwick had a role, and it wasn't hard for him to learn this because somehow the news got out to the newspapers. The Pinkertons couldn't keep a lid on that. I don't know why that got out, but it was very quickly known that Samuel Hardwick had played a role in that raid. The first thing that Hardwick did was he moved from his farm outside of town into the town of Liberty for protection. According to some newspaper reports, he went about armed when he was going about his business. But after a few months, the pressure was too much, and Samuel Hardwick decided to flee the state. And the place he fled to was St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was known that he went there because he wrote letters back to the Liberty paper. And Jesse, if anything, was a big reader of the newspapers, and he quickly learned where Samuel Hardwick was. So there were a couple of reasons to go to Minnesota. One was to hide out for a while where people wouldn't expect them, and the other was to give Jesse a chance to have his revenge on Samuel Hardwick. So these eight men arrive in Minnesota by train. They first go to the Twin Cities, and they spend a couple of weeks in St. Paul, in Minneapolis. Now, they have lots of money on them from this Rocky Cup robbery, so they go to the brothels, they go to the gambling halls. In 1876, St. Paul and Minneapolis are wide-open towns. There are brothels, and there are gambling halls. And even though they were trying to keep their identities secret, they felt pretty relaxed and pretty safe in Minnesota. And they did draw lots of attention to themselves by the way they talked. They had a Missouri drawl or dialect, which really stood out in Minnesota. The way they dressed, again, I mentioned they had these dusters. They wore broad-brimmed hats. Tall boots with big spurs, the big rowels on the spurs. That was not something you normally saw in places like St. Paul and Minneapolis. They also committed several social faux pas. They wore their hats into the dining rooms at the hotel. They actually drew up a lot of attention to themselves. But the interesting thing is that the people there, although they were curious and they questioned them about where they were from and who they were, they believed all the lies that they told. They said, well, we're railroad surveyors, we're land speculators, we're cattlemen. And once they gave those explanations, those alibis, or those characterizations, the people believed them, and they did not question them anymore. Well, as you can imagine, just like Hobbs Carey, they quickly went through a lot of the funds that they had brought with them. They were spending their money free, as they would say, in the 19th century. And they started thinking about the next job, the next bank called, and they started scouting about in different small communities in southern Minnesota. They went to Red Wing, they went to St. Peter, they went to Mankato, Medelia, Northfield, Faribault, and just took a look at the way the town was set up. They bought Minnesota maps while they were up there to figure out an escape route once they picked on a particular location. The first place that they decided upon was Mankato, Minnesota. Mankato had three banks in 1876. They scouted out each one of them. They set a day for the robbery. They ride into town, but there's a large crowd on the street that day. And not only is there a large crowd on the street in front of the bank, but they're pointing at the outlaws. They're pointing at them. And they're worried. They think they've been discovered. And, in fact, earlier that day, there was a man who recognized Jesse James. He claimed to have been from Clay County, Missouri. He said he knew the Jameses, and he actually said, "Hello, Jesse, how you doing?" And Jesse tried to ignore him and then rode away. But this man went into one of the banks and said, "You better look out, because I just saw Jesse James." And, of course, the bank people laughed at him. It's no way would Jesse James be up here. Later, they believed him, but not then. So there are all these people pointing at him. They'd had this encounter earlier in the day with someone who thought he knew Jesse James. And so they rode out. They did not commit the robbery in Mankato. What turned out happened, the reason all these people were pointing at them, they were pointing at the really nice horses that they were riding, because they had spent a lot of their money on horse flesh, $200 and more apiece for these saddle mounts. And it was very unusual in Minnesota to see someone riding a saddle horse. Generally, when you traveled about in Minnesota, you went in a buggy or you hooked up the farm nag to a wagon and you drove it into town. You didn't see people riding horses, especially groups of five or six or what have you. So these people, not only did they see these beautiful horses, but also it was unusual. Look at those guys, you know. And then these dusters that they wore were almost identical. They were all linen dusters, and it almost made them look like they were wearing uniforms to some extent. So when more than two or three were together, even two or three, it was unusual, and it drew people's attention. So they probably could have robbed the bank in Mankato, but they didn't. Second choice was Northfield, Minnesota, about 30 miles south of St. Paul. Northfield was appealing for a couple of reasons. One is it was a town of 2,000 people. It was a college town, Carleton College, just a few years old at that time. But Northfield only had one bank. Mankato had three banks. So the logic of the outlaws is, well, gee, all the money must be in this one bank. It'd be all divided up in Mankato. So that was appealing. But what was very appealing to people like Jesse James, who was a true Southern partisan, and had very strong Southern political beliefs. One of the investors of the Northfield Bank, the First National Bank, was a man named Adelbert Ames. Adelbert Ames was the first commander of the 20th Maine during the Civil War. Later, his successor was Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, who's now famous for his fight on Little Round Top. But Adelbert Ames had become a prominent general in the Civil War. After the war, he was a governor of Mississippi, a carpetbag governor is how they referred to him down south. He had a very turbulent administration there, and in fact, once the Democrats gained control of the Mississippi legislature, they threatened impeachment. And rather than be impeached, Adelbert Ames resigned, and he went to Northfield because his family operated a milling business there in Northfield. In fact, the main part of town, there's a mill square, and the mill that was right on Mill Square was Jesse Ames and Sons, and they operated that mill. Today, it's Malto Meal. So if you buy cereal like I do for my 11-year-old son, it says Northfield, Minnesota. So this was very appealing, you know. Let's hit a bank that has lots of money, but it has the money of a carpetbagger. And I think Jesse liked the idea of riding out of town with thousands of dollars that belonged to this carpetbagger who had fought for the North in the Civil War. The date for the robbery, September 7, 1876, the gang rides into town in twos and threes. They don't come together. They come from different directions. About 10 o'clock in the morning, some of the gang members actually go into the First National Bank. It's right on Division Street. And this was a very common procedure when they robbed the bank. They would go in and ask to have a bill changed. You know, can you change this $10 bill? This gives them an opportunity to see where the cash drawer is, where the safe is, how many employees are working that day. So they do go into the bank, and then these individuals leave. Some of them go and have a meal at a local restaurant. Some of the gang were seen in the saloons in town having a few drinks. And then later, about 2 o'clock, the men start converging on the First National Bank. Three men were to go into the bank and conduct the robbery. Two would be out on the street, and then three would hang back in Mill Square to protect their escape route. The three men that enter the bank are Frank James, Bob Younger, and Charlie Pitts. The men who are going to be up on the outside in the street are Clell Miller and Cole Younger, and then Jesse, Jim Younger, and Bill Chadwell are back sitting on their horses in Mill Square. Almost immediately, people are suspicious. Now, in other towns, people were curious, but in Northfield, there was this foreboding when they saw these men. There were actually individuals who thought, this doesn't look right. They saw the long dusters, all the saddle horses, and there was one man named J.S. Allen who actually followed the three men, Frank, Bob, and Charlie, as they went to the bank and went inside. J.S. Allen actually tried to get into the bank, but Clell Miller had gotten off his horse and was going to close the door, and he meets J.S. Allen face-to-face and grabs him and says, "Don't you holler." And, of course, J.S. Allen struggles. He breaks free, and he runs down the street. What does he do? He hollers, and he says, "Get your guns, boys. They're robbing the bank." And it's heard all down the street. There's a young gentleman sitting in a chair across Division Street. He's a young medical student. He's having a break from college. And he sees what's happening, and he immediately stands up and yells, "Robbery, robbery, they're robbing the bank." So the alarm has gone off really within seconds that the gang is trying to rob this bank. As soon as J.S. Allen rounds the corner around the Scriber block, he's yelling, "The bank is being robbed." There are men on the street. They hear him. Almost immediately, people start going for their guns. These citizens are not going to allow their bank to be robbed. They're not going to allow these brigands to take their money. You have to remember, at this time, there's no federal deposit insurance to protect your funds. So if that money is taken or stolen, you're not getting it back. It's gone. They're robbing each person individually. So there's an incentive for them to resist these robbers. And they don't know who they are at this time. They only know that someone is robbing the bank. Now, where do they go to get their gun? In Minnesota, people aren't walking around like in Deadwood with a six-shooter on their hip. In fact, nobody's walking around with a gun. But there are certain places that people know where the guns are. And where you buy a gun in Minnesota in 1876 is the hardware store. Just around the corner from the bank are two hardware stores. And one of the stores, as soon as they hear the alarm and people are shouting and it's all commotion, one of the employees starts taking guns out of the cases and laying them up on top of the counters with ammunition. So they're grabbing shotguns. They're grabbing revolvers. One of the hardware store owners, remember, he had a Remington rolling block rifle up in the window in the front of the store. He grabs his rifle. He races up to the corner, and they start blasting away at the men in the street. By this time, the three men in Mill Square have risen around the corner to support the guys inside the bank. So you've got five men out in the street riding back and forth, shouting at townspeople to get back inside. Go back, get back inside, and they're firing their guns over their heads near them to scare them, to get them away so they can buy time for the men that are inside. Now, you can imagine the confusion for people in Northfield, everyday citizens, maybe they're shopping, they're in a store, and they see these riders going back and forth, and it does not enter their mind that something bad or horrible is happening. It defies any kind of logic. Something like this would happen in Northfield. There has to be some other explanation to what's going on. Now, it turns out that night there was supposed to be a big show by this illusionist named Professor Lingard. And Professor Lingard was going to have a show, and part of his show, he was going to have a balloon ascension. He had two balloons that were going to rise up, and he was going to do this for the public and then get people to come inside and pay for the show. And so some of the first thoughts are, oh, this is to advertise the show. This is not any kind of a robbery or a shootout. This is a great way of advertising the show. There's a dentist who has an office on the upper story above, on the second floor that's not far from the bank, and he steps out on the landing. And as he steps out, the robbers are yelling, "Get back in," and they're firing towards him, and there's stuff popping off of the building. And he jumps back in, and he asks the lady, he says, "What's going on?" "Oh, that's probably a Wild West show that's going on out there." And so he goes back out, and he gets shot at again. It took a couple of times it was just so beyond imagination this would be happening in this little town of 2,000 people where these horrible things don't happen in Northfield. So this is going on constantly. Initially, the outlaws are not shooting to kill, but the townspeople are shooting to kill. They are actually trying to kill these men that they've determined are the robbers or the bad guys. Ansel Manning with his Remington rolling block rifle, he takes a bead on the robbers who are ducking behind their horses, and since he can't get one of the robbers, he kills one of the horses, and it collapses right in front of the bank. And then his gun jammed, so he has to run back and clear it and get another round in. Henry Wheeler, that medical student, he remembered there was an old Civil War carbine in the Dampier House Hotel, which is just a store or two down. So he runs back through the alley and goes in and grabs the carbine. He goes upstairs into the Dampier House, and he has a perfect view down below to where the riders are going back and forth, and he zeroes in on Clell Miller, who is adjusting. It looks like he's adjusting something on his saddle. He's bent over, and he fires, and he sends a bullet right through Clell Miller's artery, and Clell Miller falls off, and he bleeds to death there on the steps. Eyewitnesses said they thought he was giving orders till the end and yelling, and finally all his blood pumped out. and he's dead. So one man is already killed. Ansel Manning, a little bit later, draws a bead on one of the other riders, Bill Chadwell, and he shoots him dead. The gang has lost two members in the street. The seconds are ticking by, and the reason the seconds are ticking by are because of a heroic employee in the bank. You remember I said the cashier went to Philadelphia for the exposition? Well, the man that took his place was the treasurer. He wasn't the cashier, but that day he was the acting cashier. His name was Joseph Lee Haywood. The three men burst in. Alonzo Bunker is the teller. He meets him at the window, and they've got three revolvers pointed at his head. And at first he thinks some friends are playing a joke on him. You know, nobody robs. I've never been in a bank robbery before. You know, who are these guys? Quickly, he realizes that these men are up to no good, that they're very, very serious. And they keep yelling, "Who's the cashier? Where's the cashier?" Alonzo Bunker is silent. Frank Wilcox, another employee, is silent. Joseph Lee Haywood is at the desk of the cashier, and he says calmly, "He's not in. The cashier's not in today." And he wasn't. But they all jump over the counter, and they keep pointing the revolvers, "Who's the cashier?" And finally, they see the cashier's desk, and Frank Jing says, "You're the cashier. Open the safe." And he resists. Often the people that were in charge of money to protect it, whether it's a cashier or express agent, they would try to deceive robbers and outlaws. So the first thing that Joseph Lee Haywood says, it's on a time lock. Now, you probably heard the story of the time lock, and time locks were just coming into vogue at this time. A time lock was designed to be engaged at the end of the business day and then to be disengaged at the beginning of the business day. So no bank in its right mind would have a time lock engaged during business hours because nobody could get into the safe to conduct any transactions. The gang knew this. The whole reason for a time lock was to prevent outlaws to kidnap a banker in the middle of the night, take him to the bank, and force him to open the safe. There's a time lock on there. It doesn't matter whether you're the owner or the teller or cashier. You cannot open that safe until the clock strikes the right time and it's disengaged. But the outlaws knew that this was just a lie to buy time by Haywood and says, "That's a lie. Open the safe." And Frank James actually starts to go into the vault, and Haywood leaps over and tries to slam the vault door on him, and there's a scuffle. And so all this commotion and confusion, this resistance, which they weren't expecting, is making the seconds tick by and is making it very deadly for the men in the street. That's why they lose two men, and the other men are getting wounded with shotgun pellets, all kinds of things that are happening out there as Haywood has bought time inside the bank. What the gang didn't know, what Frank James didn't know, was that had he gone into this vault and tried the handle, that safe was open. It had been unlocked. The bolts were not disengaged. Had he just turned the handle and pulled it open, there was $15,000 in that safe. Instead, they're rummaging around out in the counter looking for the cash drawer. Bob Younger ends up scooping up some spare change and some scripts, some paper money. And it's about $26.40 is all he gathers. They never get into the vault. They never get into that safe. While they're struggling with Haywood, Alonzo Bunker, the teller, he panics because he sees Frank James draw up his revolver and point it towards Haywood, and then he fires it over Haywood's head. Bunker doesn't know this, but this is to scare Haywood, to shock him into opening the safe. Well, Alonzo Bunker thinks that they just murdered Haywood. And Alonzo Bunker bolts, and he runs for the back door. Charlie Pitts runs after him, fires one shot, which hits the blinds next to the door, and then Bunker bursts out the back. Charlie Pitts follows him and shoots at him again, and a bullet goes through Bunker's shoulder. He staggers, but he keeps running. He's got away. Again, this is the confusion that the robbers are dealing with. Things are going wrong. Anything that could go wrong did go wrong as they're trying to rob this bank. So Frank James fires a bullet over Haywood's head. Charlie Pitts, he actually runs a big knife along Haywood's throat, makes a flesh wound. Haywood is not cooperating. In fact, he's basically knocked senseless. He yells, "Murder, murder!" And Frank James, to get him to quiet down, hits him with his revolver. And at this point, Cole Younger keeps riding up to the door of the bank, and he says, "Come out. They're shooting all our men. Get out." You know, he rides up three different times. And finally, Bob Younger and Charlie Pitts burst out the front door, and they look for the horses. Of course, Bob Younger's horse is dead. Frank James is the last one to leave. And out of pure meanness and pure spite and vengeance, as he's crawling over the counter, he levels his revolver at Haywood, who has stumbled to his desk, and he puts a bullet right through Haywood's head and murders him. Frank Wilcox witnesses this murder, and then he flees through the back door himself. Frank James rushes out. They're all scrambling for horses. Bob Younger races down the sidewalk because people like Anselm Manning and others are shooting from around the corner, and Cole Younger's killed that man at the corner, and they're dodging back and forth around this stairwell, and finally Bob Junger starts shooting through the stairway and trying to get Anselm Manning, who backs off. By this time, most of the gang are mounted. Bob Junger, as he's there at the corner, there's one more shot that comes from the Dampier House Hotel from Henry Wheeler, the medical student. It shatters Bob Younger's elbow. That's with his gun hand. Bob Junger coolly tosses the gun to his left hand and keeps blasting away. But as the men are riding off, he looks back and he says, "My God, boys, don't leave me. I'm wounded." And Cole Younger gallops back, grabs Bob Junger, pulls him up on the horse, and six men gallop out of town. They leave two of their men dead in the street. It only takes about 7 minutes for all of this to transpire. It was 7 minutes of high excitement, of terror, and mass confusion, and it truly was a melee in the street. Joseph Lee Haywood is the hero because he's prevented these funds from being taken for the bank safe. To give you another little motivation for Haywood to resist the robbers, Haywood was also the treasurer at Carleton College. He knew that all the money from the college was in that safe. Had that money been taken, the college could have been ruined. So he had lots of incentives to resist these robbers. There were other heroes in addition to Haywood. There were some individuals who couldn't find guns, and so they threw rocks at the robbers. And so not only were they dodging bullets, but they're dodging these missiles that are coming through the air and disrupt.
Well, I think you'll agree that our gentleman here, Mark Lee Gardner, is very good at description and detailed description of this particular crime. I taught a course for 12 or 15 years called Analysis of Robbery, and there are all kinds of different robbers, and bank robbers are some of the best, but we also deploy a lot of forces to catch them and to prevent bank robberies, of course. So if you rob a bank, you may get away with it for a while, but you're gonna get caught and you're going to do time. Of course, some of them think it's worth it because they'll get out and still maybe have some money somewhere. But anyway, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed that. You can go to Book TV and hear the rest of the story. I think you would truly enjoy this. And what we'll do now, as we do every week, we'll have Vera Lynn sing her wonderful song, "We'll Meet Again," and see you next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please